This is the Tame Aperture Podcast.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Do you read me, Hal? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Come on down and jump some of this shit.
You'll always have power. Sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Welcome to the Tame Aperture Podcast, where we talk about all things movies from first-time directors, indie films, art house, and much, much more. Today, we're diving into the 1999 coming-of-age comedy drama SLC Punk. The IMDb logline reads, "In the early 1980s, Steve-O and Heroin Bob are the only two dedicated punks in conservative Salt Lake City." I'm Alan Martindale, editor and filmmaker, and along for the ride, as always, is our fearless leader, Gabe Vienendahl, filmmaker, film instructor, and film evangelist. Gabe, how the hell you doing? And what do you think that log line covers it?
Anarchy, bitches. I mean,
anarchy, bitches.
I like that one better.
I do too. In fact, we'll re-record that and put that in there.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
You said, I read somewhere it said comedy musical.
Musical?
Yes, this is, I could be wrong. I was reading somewhere and I was like, what the hell are they talking about?
Comedy. It might just because they have tons of music in there.
They have tons
of, sounds like an AI thing.
Yeah, could be.
So before we get going, as always, full spoilers. We recommend you go watch the movie, as we always do, because we're going to spoil the shit out of it. And there's some big spoilers in here. And I'm going to start off without fully spoiling it, but I am going to ask, Gabe, did you cry?
I saw the film when it came out, or thereabouts, a little after, I would say. Back when it was released on DVD back in the day, or whatever it is. I saw the film in my undergraduate studies at the University of Utah. I think they just showed it to us because it was filmed in Salt Lake City.
Right, right.
Mostly. That's 20 plus years ago. And so I remember the film, but not overly familiar in the sense of like rewatching it constantly.
So that was the only time you'd seen it?
That was really the only time I seen it, so I remembered it. And I obviously remembered it had some kind of, you know, it had a Sundance premiere and that kind of stuff, but just kind of walked away. So this was probably the second viewing I had. I did not cry, but that's because I'm an old, hardened curmudgeon.
Heartless piece of shit is what you're trying to say, yeah.
There's some soft spots to the film. We won't give away those immediately, but... I don't see the necessity on this particular film to cry.
You got to be kidding me. First of all, despite what Quentin Tarantino thinks, Matthew Lillard can act the shit out of whatever. Like that scene, the crying scene that we'll talk about later, that was insane. Like his performance in that was unreal.
Great performance all around.
Right.
I mean, you look at what he's coming off of. It's like in this time frame, kind of late 90s, obviously Scream.
Right.
Right. Big role in Scream. He's great in that, which is a great, great franchise movie. The origin movie.
Yep.
13 Ghosts. I remember that film. It was kind of me.
Scooby-Doo.
And then Scooby-Doo, another franchise movie, which you're going to think this is funny, but I actually like the first Scooby-Doo.
I have not seen it, so I really can't.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's nostalgic. We used to watch it with my kids, but I actually think it's a really kind of fun. And they did the characters. I liked the cartoon growing up.
Yeah,
I liked the Scooby-Doo cartoons, right. The Mystery Van and all the stuff. And I think they did a good job portraying that. So, yeah, Matthew Lillard has got some serious acting chops, you know, even being outside of franchise movies. I mean, even most recently, you know, Five Nights at Freddy's and things like that. Like, dude can act. So
he's been in a lot of stuff. He's got a lot of range. I mean, he does have the Matthew Lillard thing, you know, overly animated, you know, I'm getting woozy here at the end of Scream type of stuff. Like, I think I understand what Quentin Tarantino was saying when he's talking shit about him, but...
Well, let's clarify, because I want to hear, what does Tarantino say?
Well, so Tarantino was on Bret Easton Ellis's podcast, which, and if you don't know, Bret Easton Ellis wrote the book American Psycho that the film is based off of. And apparently he has a podcast, Tarantino went on there to talk about his favorite or his top 20 movies of the century or something. I don't know what it was. And his list is ridiculous. I wish I'm going to pull it up because it is absolutely fucking insane. Some of the shit he has on there. But in it, he actually says, and you've seen There Will Be Blood, right?
What, it's my favorite PTA film.
What do you think of...
Followed by Punch Drunk Love.
Right. I mean, they're fantastic.
Which are two completely opposites.
Before I go
on... Sorry, I got sidetracked.
No, you're good.
You bring up There Will Be Blood, and now this turned... we lost our focus on SLC Punk.
I know. We'll get back to it, I promise. This all ties into Matthew Lillard. But would you say there was a bad... Let's see, a drawback in the acting, of anyone's performance, would you say there was a bad performance in There Will Be Blood?
A bad performance. We know.
Or a performance that takes you out.
In this one, I did read the article. I know he talked shit on Paul Dano.
Right.
Which I disagree with.
I wholeheartedly disagree. Like, that is fucking insane, dude.
Paul Dano's great. I'm not just saying that like, I'm going to say the, it's a great movie. He carries that. Along with Daniel Day. So in that particular, I mean, I just think the acting in There Will Be Blood is, I don't know. I hold it at high esteem. Say that.
We're going to have to do that because I love that film too. And I just think to say that Paul Dano was supposed to play the polar opposite of Daniel Day-Lewis. And that's exactly what he did. Yeah. And I think I almost think that he was so good that Tarantino knocks him for it.
QT's wrong.
He's fucking wrong, dude. He loves stirring up trouble, though. That's the thing, is he loves...
I love his films. Most of his films I love, but he's wrong.
He's totally wrong.
Yeah.
He's absolutely wrong. And then in the same breath, same interview, he mentions that he can't stand Owen Wilson and he can't stand Matthew Lillard. He doesn't go as hard in on Matthew Lillard, but he does mention him as a person that he can't stand. And I don't understand it, man. Like, I don't... Acting-wise, he does do his thing, like his shtick, like Christopher Walken has his thing that everyone knows him for. Matthew Lillard has his thing that everyone knows him for, just his cadence and the way he speaks. But you can't say he's a bad actor.
I mean, anybody that goes and watches this movie has to realize what acting is about.
Exactly.
What I mean by that is you have, it's kind of ensemble to some degree.
Sure.
But you got to have someone steering the boat. It's not easy as an actor to keep momentum going for 90 minutes to 2 hours. You could fall out of that easily. I will say this, and we'll get into the nitty gritty of the film, but Lillard does that. He steers the boat. He keeps you engaged. There's interest. It's nothing that his acting can't do to carry an entire audience for 2 hours. Think about it this way. It's like stand-up comedy,
right?
Someone goes on stage. It's a single guy or a girl. They're up there. They got to carry it for an hour.
Right.
And if they don't, it's pretty easy. In the first 10 or 15 minutes, it's easily identifiable that this sucks.
Yep. Absolutely.
So if Lillard has that, then the movie sucks. And I will say this, and we'll get into more detail later. I'm curious to hear your thoughts because I have a lot. But... Lillard does not do that.
Right.
Right. So I keep the momentum. I keep it going. And that's not an easy task as an actor to carry a film.
Especially when you consider how many times he's monologuing to the camera.
Oh, I would.
And he's got to go in and out of scenes, in and out of interactions with characters. And then he's talking to the camera. Now he's doing this. Now he's screaming. Now he's laughing. Like, he's all over the place.
Yeah, that crossover is crazy. Where you break the fourth wall and then step out behind step back to the normal setting and start interacting with real characters that are now it's a weird style too. It's very dynamic.
Right.
We can talk about that, but he can do it and he does it well.
He kills it. He kills it. The reason why, and I chose this one,
no shit, Sherlock. I only say that because anybody that knows Alan knows that he's a punk rock fan.
I came up going to a lot of shows. Now this takes place in 1985. My stint was about 10 years later. So I was not there in 85.
You were towards the end of punk rock. Is it ended?
Well, apparently he's dead, right?
Well, that's what they say. That's what I mean.
That's they've been saying that since about 81. So,
well, that's what I mean. Like you were coming in the mid 90s. It was definitely you're an expert at this, but like it was definitely transitioning out of punk rock or nearly dead.
It was punk rock has always been there. What started to happen was it started to get popular. And okay. Here's the thing that young me didn't understand the irony of this shit because this is the thing that and I'm sure you got this from the movie and obviously just being alive is that punks have opinions, very strong opinions. And whether you want to know what their opinions are or not, they're going to fucking tell you. And that's exactly what I was like. And I hated all the famous fucking bands and how it was just like, I was just so dumb, right? Like everyone's popular and like Green Day's big and now The Offspring's big and then Blink 182. But the thing is, if it wasn't for Green Day and The Offspring, I never would have got into it in the fucking first place. Like they were gateway bands to me, literally. I heard their sound, I liked it, and then I dove deeper into the more underground stuff that really wasn't that underground.
Yeah, the history.
Right, right. Yeah. So back in the day, from what I understand, like in the 80s, it was a lot more dangerous. It was a lot more violent. It was a lot more, it was kind of risky to be a punk because you did get your ass kicked a lot. And it doesn't matter. Like everyone talks about the LA scenes and the New York scenes and stuff, but it was like that here too, from what I've heard.
And yeah, I think they play into that really well.
They do.
I mean, the idea that it actually took place here is quite interesting. And having grown up here, I go, oh, I guess that was a subculture that for me, I would have been unaware of. I mean, obviously I was really, really, really young, so I wouldn't have known anyway.
Right.
But looking back on it going, oh yeah, it took place in smaller cities as well.
It did, absolutely. And we say here, we should probably mention that we live and record in Salt Lake City, grew up here. And so like for me, this is an incredibly like personal film to me back then. And it's only gotten more relevant to my life as I've gotten older, which is fucking weird to say, because this is a total coming of age movie. And I didn't understand. I loved it. I loved that there was a film that was getting buzz about the punk scene, that it was in Salt Lake City, which is always overlooked by everyone, whether it's, you know, music or sports or whatever, like everyone just were an afterthought or not thought about at all. And it's indie film. It's like the three fucking things for me, man. Like
it's not just indie film. It's indie film that was successful, played at Sundance, which is also in our backyard.
Exactly.
About a movie that was taking place in our backyard.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of cool, you know, at least for us locally, there's a lot of cool buzz around the movie.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So I didn't fully understand it back then. Cause when this came out, I was a senior in high school, I think. And I didn't understand. I just couldn't comprehend the coming of age thing because I hadn't come of age.
But you saw it when it came. So it came out in 98.
It's either
98, 99.
Right. One of those two.
Because it premiered somewhere at Sundance here. And I didn't even see it until after.
Me too.
Like early 2000s.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. I saw it at the theater at Cottonwood Mall.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's ironic because some of it takes place in the Cottonwood Mall.
Yeah, exactly. This is why I've been wanting to talk about this for a while. And just based on, you know, a personal project I'm working on right now, like it's hitting all the themes that like shit that I'm interested in. And I've been like thinking about and diving into that world again. So that's why I chose this.
It probably doesn't hold the same sentimental value to me as it does you. Although rewatching it for the second time, it started to attach a little more. Like I started going, this is kind of cool. This is kind of neat to see all this. I'm 80 now. I say words like neat. Hey, this is real neat, guys.
That's pretty nifty.
I just came from coaching kids in basketball, so I have to keep my language at a minimum. I have to say things like neat.
Neat, yeah.
But so I think I'm curious to hear how it affected you when you watched it. Because for me, I watched it the first time way after it came out. I'm talking years, 3, 4, 5 years after.
Mm-hmm.
You saw it in the theater and you're part of that. You love that subculture of punk rock. Did you just walk out going, found my favorite movie of all time.
Kind of. I mean, a little bit, but also when you get to the end, when he basically sells out, quote unquote sells out, I was like, this is bullshit, dude. I was walking out of the theater being like, this is fucking bullshit. Like, they had it. It was so good. And then he just sold out. But that was like, that's the whole point of the movie, is that like, he loves anarchy. And they misunderstand what anarchy actually is throughout the whole movie. It kind of drives me crazy. But he loves chaos. And that's a metaphor for youth and being young and carefree and doing whatever the hell you want and fighting and drinking and having sex and going to shows and all this stuff. And like, he's fighting against order and sustainability. But that's really what growing up is.
Yeah.
Is you have to have that, and you feel lost without it at a certain point. And so that I was too young to understand that that's what the movie was about. And so I walked out pissed off, but now I'm watching it and I'm like, oh yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. But so do you think, I mean, you mentioned how much is going on in this movie. A lot of dialogue. As you say, it's a talkie. I love it. I love the dialogue. Like, I love it, but is there too much? I mean, is there too much going on?
I just wrote a 20-minute film that's all talking, so.
Well, I guess
I'm all for it. I'm okay with it. It keeps me engaged. I'm not the kind of guy that's like, oh, I need more action. And right, I'm not a studio executive that comes in and goes, oh, less talking, more action. And but it's like,
do you think this handled it well? Was there too much going on? Like, did it all, was it all, I don't know. Was it just, did it hold together?
That's a big question. I mean, it's loaded.
Right.
You know, I always overthink things.
Me too.
So this is where I need to just take a moment and think, but because I always overanalyze it all. Do I think it holds it together well? I think, like we talked about with Lillard's acting, it holds together well because he's engaging and he's interesting. And then you start formulating opinions around how he's saying things. And in many cases, which I think is intentional from the filmmaker, he's contradicting himself the whole movie.
Yeah. Yep.
He's a walking contradiction.
He even talks about it.
And then he also addresses it and lets you know. So I think it does hold together well from that perspective. I'm always one, like, I would look at it this way. It'd be interesting, like, it's cool the style in which they do it, where he breaks the fourth wall, like we talked about. It's like, it's kind of got the Ferris Bueller vibes in the sense that they're both kind of against the system. Ferris does it, we'll call it, in a less punk way.
I don't, or for, right, like traditional punk, like he doesn't look, but Ferris Bueller is pretty fucking punk rock, man.
Okay. Well, if you say it, then I believe it, and I do see what you're saying. So I just feel like he kind of took that system and kind of put it into Steve-O's world.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Agreed. Agreed.
He's like, Steve-O's like who Ferris Bueller would be if Ferris wasn't like, mommy, daddy. You know?
Exactly.
Ferris might even be more punk than Steve-O.
I think he is, because he knows how to play him.
Because he plays he plays.
And Steve-O can't keep Steve-O, his mouth shut.
He can't help but say things and be too honest. Almost.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Yep, for sure.
Because Ferris plays the system. Anyway, but there's an interesting dynamic there. It'd be fun to like look into like Ferris and Steve-O's personalities.
It would be. Another thing that really resonated with me when I was younger and now is that I grew up in Salt Lake. You grew up in Salt Lake. I was never a Mormon. I was never LDS, never part of any religion, actually, which caused even more, like, the kids at school couldn't understand that I didn't have any religion. So the first question was always, are you Mormon? And I'd say no. And like, well, what second question, what religion are you? And I'd say, well, I'm not any religion. And they would go, oh, you're probably Catholic. But it would blow their mind that there was that I had no religion. So that resonated with me as well. And so
you were bad religion.
there you go. There you go. One of the greatest bands of all time. So that resonated with me as well. I mean, as someone, cause you did grow up LDS, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. How does someone who grew up LDS, how do you relate?
I mean, I had a handful of friends growing up that were not Mormon. Of course, you're very heavily influenced here around the Mormon culture. But it never was a thing for, it must be pockets in which you grow up in.
I think so.
And what I mean by that is there's just like, whether that's junior high, high school, or the pods in the community that you're specifically in, like it was never a thing. And what I mean is I had a handful of friends that were Catholic, or they just, and it wasn't a thing for us. But I do know that a lot of people are not like that. Like,
sure.
And what I mean is like, there are Mormons out there that are very, I'm trying to be somewhat politically correct because I want to be
like judgmental.
100%.
Yeah. And I don't think it's exclusive to Mormons either. Like it's
100%.
Everyone judgmental. Is yeah. like, and,
but here's the thing too, Al, and it's interesting conversation. Cause it's like, you grow up in Mormonville. I was going to call it Mormonville, which is Salt Lake City. it's like Whoville. Yahoo Dore. Yahoo Dore.
Exactly. Yep, that's it.
But it shouldn't be. Everyone in the movie, he's always talking about the cultural things. I think what you relate to is that you're like him. Like he came here, or he's part being here with his father. And they move here and then they don't have a religion. And then they're getting asked all these questions. And you're like, that's an interesting relationship. Cause I wouldn't know how that feels. But for me personally, it was never a thing. And now I sound like I'm backing off of it, but it's true. Like it just, my parents have friends that aren't Mormon. It just never was in the mix.
Sure.
But I will say this, that's probably rarefied territory. In it here, I feel like there's a lot of pockets that are probably the opposite of that.
I think it could be. I see everyone was nice to me. There were two things that would happen, and we'll get back to the actual film.
Well, it's part of the film because he brings it up continually throughout the film.
And this, I mean, this movie is just so crazy. Like, there's so many parallels to my life, and I'll talk about some other ones in a minute. But like, so what would happen was everyone would always be nice, and this is when I was a little kid, especially. All the other kids were nice to me. But without knowing, they would make like it's like they wouldn't try and be mean, but they just say things like
there's unintentional bias.
Exactly. Yeah. Just because that's how they were raised and I didn't understand it. And then the other thing was that they would always try and get me to go to church with them. And they try and get me to.
That part's for 100% true.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
The conversion is, I think that's lessened over the years. I could be wrong because I haven't.
Right.
Really been part of the church for a long time, but that was 100% true. Yeah.
And
hey, everybody, let's get Steve-O to.
And this is like way before I even knew what punk rock was, but I think that spirit's always been in me because the more someone tried to make me do something, the more I'm like, no, fuck you, dude. I don't want to go. And it wasn't even that I didn't want their church. It's like, I didn't want them to tell me what to do. You know, it could have been anything. Like they could have been.
Well, I'll say this, growing up Mormon, you and I are like there.
It's true. It's very true.
And I was a good, now look, that's what's kind of interesting in that conversation because I, growing up a good Mormon boy, hated, and I still did and was like part of it, but like I hated people telling teachers.
Right.
I was anti-authoritarian. Yep. Those pink slips calls to the mom. I mean, I just hated. No, you don't get to tell me what to do.
I think, I think that's why we get along so well. I know that's why my wife and I get along so well, because she's the exact same. Because she grew up in Price, which is, you know, a little bit south. And she was never part of, like down there it was Catholic, also Mormons. But she was never part of that religion. And that's, I think, why I gravitated towards her. Because she's also like, you trying to make me do something? No.
You want
absolutely not. And I think that's why you and I get along too.
It probably is. You know, I want to know what's crazy? Is that okay? My mom and dad are both Mormon and they're great people. I love them to death. And I'm gonna be honest here. And you're talking about like family and the dynamics and how people, my mom's more punk rock than anybody I've ever met.
Dude.
You know what she told me the other day? We were with the family, we're joking around, everyone's laughing, and we're going, and we're talking about a comedian. I can't remember who it was. And she looks at me and the whole family, she's like, I hate comedy. And she wasn't joking.
That's amazing.
And she goes, I hate jokes.
Oh my God.
It's amazing. As soon as she said that, we all started just busting our asses up laughing.
That is so, because where did you come from? Because you love comedy.
I love comedy, but I just mean she, and this is not to dive off topic too much, but I look at it and go, my mom growing up, that's where it comes from me.
Right.
It's like, she's a beautiful person. She's super nice and lovely to everyone. Sorry, I didn't mean to get off tangent.
No,
I'm like, who's more punk rock than my Mormon mom? And that it sounds crazy, but there's something to it. If you knew her, you'd be like, yeah, that makes sense.
I believe it wholeheartedly, for sure. Okay, so now we kind of established the setting and what it was like and, you know, what this movie especially means to me. The structure is a little weird. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's completely nonlinear, but it is. But I don't know if it was, it almost feels like it was done on accident. Like it was just almost done in the editing room. No, it wasn't done in the editing room. It just feels like there was.
I didn't feel that.
Really?
In what way? Like you feel like there was no continual
storyline
like, that kind of propelled to the end and it felt kind of forward momentum. Like it didn't feel too nonlinear for me. I might be missing something.
He'd be telling a story and then in the story, we go back to another flashback back to, you know, and, which is fine.
That's like, right.
I think it worked, but it's unconventional.
It's unconventional, but I think they made it work. I mean, the editing style is dynamic.
I love the editing in this one.
And if you would have asked me, this is where the dumb experience and training of being a filmmaker and a teacher is like, if you would have asked me 20 years ago, I'd be like, editing's supposed to be about not seeing the edit.
Sometimes it's not, though.
And now 20 years later, I go, I loved that editing style.
I did too. And that this was kind of...
And for those listening, it's jump cuts. It's a little bit what you're saying. It kind of flashbacks. And so I get what you're saying. Like it's a little bit...
Like freeze frames, like weird frame transition. And I think it's done... Well, I know it's done on purpose in order to help convey the chaotic life of punk and quote-unquote anarchy, as they like to call it. I'm going to say this film has one of my absolute, probably... top five favorite scenes in all of cinema ever.
Should I try to guess it?
Yeah, let's see if you can guess it.
Top five?
Maybe even more. Like, I can't.
Favorite scenes.
Favorite. And I'm not saying best scene.
Give me, I don't want you to give me a hint. I don't do that. Don't give me no fucking hints. Okay, I'm way off here. This is one, because it stands out. It's probably not it. But when they're with Heroin Bob, Steve-O, and is it Michael? No, Mike? Jason Siegel.
Oh, yeah. I think that's Mike, I think. Yeah.
So Mike, in the booth, where like transitions when Mike talks about going to be a botanist at
that's
Northern
not
Game,
it, but like, I love that.
Where like
that.
Totally comes out of the movie.
Yeah.
And then there's a weird push in and then.
Yeah. I love that. And I love how that's done. Like just it's
it worked.
Like that.
And it's
worked.
Weird.
It could have.
Okay, that's not it. I knew that wasn't it. Man, I can't.
It is.
Favorite scene.
You want me to just tell you?
Yeah.
It is when he's talking to his parents after he just graduated high school. And his mohawk is the biggest thing you've ever seen. Like to me, just the language, the comedy. Like just everything about that scene just makes me die laughing every time. And just
what about it though? Break it down real quick.
It is the funniest shit I've ever seen in my life.
Okay, but that doesn't help the audience.
You just see the parents, right? And they're just like, thanks for joining us. We wanted to talk to you about your future.
Single
and all this shit.
Single two shot. They're just talking. And the parents, you can tell there's a disconnect.
Right, right. Even though they're still calling each other dear and honey.
Yeah, they're faking it.
And then up to this point, we've seen Steve-O with his blue hair, and it's kind of like messy and a little spiky, and but not like ridiculous. And then hard cut to Steve-O sitting across the room listening to them with the biggest fucking mohawk you've ever seen in your life. It's flopping everywhere.
The size of that mohawk.
It is insane. And he's just sitting, and the faces he's making, and he's flashing him peace signs, and like, yeah, man, like he's really engaging with them. But like
I was gonna say, he actually feels like he's not like me. I'm cutting you off. I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
But he's like, he feels like he's a pretty good listener.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's also giving them a big fuck you while he's listening.
Yeah, birds flying.
Yeah, exactly. And then the speech he gives is just the funniest thing ever because it's so unbelievably cliche punk rock, like wannabe anarchist, think you're deep, but also there's truth to it. Like it sounds
like this podcast.
Exactly. That's exactly what this is. To me, that is just that's one of my favorite scenes in any movie I've ever seen ever.
I will say this, the end of that scene's also pretty funny. After he leaves and tells his parents, I'm not doing what you want me to do, blah, blah, blah. Yep. I'm not going to Harvard. I'm going to the University of Utah.
He talks about how much he hates Salt Lake all the time and is like, Harvard out, University of Utah in. Yeah. It's like, why don't you get the fuck out of here then, dude? Like, yeah.
I'm a U of U alum, so shout out.
Yeah, I went there too. Yeah, exactly. But the line that I loved is, and to me, this is kind of what the whole movie's about, is even though I think it's kind of a throwaway funny line, is when Steve was walking out and his dad stops him and he goes, hey, just remember, I didn't sell out. I bought in. And that's what the whole movie's about, basically.
He does buy in at the end.
He does.
Okay.
So that's
that makes sense. That scene's great. And I also love that the director decided and the filmmaker decided not to like make it crazy. It's like literally two shots, one, two, cut back and forth.
Yep.
Parents, Steve-O. And it's just natural.
Which is so contrary to everything else.
Most of the other stuff in the film has a lot of crane shots or aerials or craziness, and that scene's just back and forth.
Yep. I love it. I mean, to me, that's just, it's so well written, so well
directed. Guess my favorite scene. Okay. Overall scene.
In the movie.
There's a lot of good fun ones, but like, guess.
Is it the one with Sean on acid outside his house? So Devin Sawa.
That's a pretty good, it's so good guess. Man.
It's so good.
But it's not that one.
What is it?
That's a pretty good guess. My favorite scene is when they go to Evanston.
Oh.
And inside the liquor store, the people talking about all the heathens coming in and God's wrath and all these things, and they start playing the British accents. And that whole scene to me is really, really funny.
It's so funny, man. It makes me – so at the end of the scene, there are these two people in the Evanston, Wyoming liquor store, and they're talking – about the end of the world and how like all the signs are here, the devil worshipers are here. And to end the scene, Steve-O flashes his ass and he's got 666 tattooed on his ass. And to me, I'm like, I got to go get that tattoo.
I thought that was so hilarious.
It's so good.
I thought he was just going to moon him. Like it was just going to be like, hey, but he actually had it tattooed. So I just thought that whole scene was how it was built was really funny.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is I think people forget that this is a real comedy. Like the majority of it is a comedy. Like it's hilarious. It's some of the funniest stuff I've seen consistently throughout a film. And maybe that's part of it. It's just because I relate to a lot of what they're talking about.
I was going to say, I think a part of it's that.
You're like, huh, this, huh?
No, it's funny. I think it's done really well. And there's like really comedic moments and it's funny and I think it's worth a watch. I think it's also like, especially if you're kind of like in the know of the punk culture, but even more so like the SLC culture, and then how that kind of plays in is kind of interesting. I think anyone that is in that's why I found it appealing and interesting too.
Yeah.
You know?
And I would love to talk to someone.
I don't know if it relates to other people.
I know. Cause I'd love to talk to someone, from outside of Salt Lake to see what they thought about this. I mean, this movie is kind of still kind of loved in punk circles.
Well, it bombed at the box office.
Yeah, bad. Real bad. And it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's not really made for everybody. I think it's made for film buffs, for punks, for people from Salt Lake. It's a very personal film to James Marandino, who directed it.
It's not an autobiography, but it kind of is.
Yeah. He named a lot of the characters after people he knew. He wrote some characters based on people he knew. And apparently, I don't know, there's some controversy over it. I don't know, but he went to Judge High and he would get his ass kicked. And so he kind of found,
which is a Catholic high school, by the way.
Yeah. Cause he was a Catholic in Salt Lake City. And so he found punk and he kind of draped himself in it to kind of protect himself, you know, like. And I get that, man. When you're an outsider, you kind of want some sort of identity. And it's like, you're going to tell me I'm an outsider. I'm going to be an outsider then.
I feel like, though, what's cool about the movie is, like, it's not really just, like, punk culture.
Right.
I mean, it is. It's dressed in that. But the reality is, like, it feel what's punk, what's interesting about punk in general, and you're the expert, so correct me if I'm off base here. I don't know if I understand it all, but I just know this. Every subculture is punk.
Yes.
Yours was like punk. The music was how you associated in that sense. Right. And you did it in other ways too. But like for me, I was a hip hop kid.
Right.
So it's punk as a Mormon kid to at 13 years old to go buy Ice Cube the Predator, bump it in your basement. You know what I mean?
Totally. Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing is it's the term punk rock is just, it's not, it doesn't just describe music. Yeah. It does describe the music, but more than anything, it's kind of an attitude.
It's an attitude.
And it's a good thing and bad thing at the same time. There's a lot in this movie though, that's a little like makes me roll my eyes, cringy kind of shit. And it's,
I'd love to hear what those couple things are.
I don't know. That whole monologue about the British punk stuff was just like,
you felt the way he felt about the British punk stuff, about
exactly.
That scene.
Exactly. It's just like, oh man, I don't know. There's a lot in there that's just, not beating around the bush. It's very direct and just subtle at all.
Who is responsible for punk rock, Alan? The Ramones or the Sex Pistols?
Have you heard the new Smiths album? It's terrific. That's just hilarious to me. Okay. So, I mean, those are my feelings. It's not a perfect movie, obviously. It's got a lot of, I guess, 90s tropes that are, maybe they weren't tropes at the time, but just like a lot of the flashy editing, a lot of the freeze frames, a lot of the fourth wall breaking. When I was reading some reviews of this movie, a lot of people mentioned that, how it's just a typical pretentious indie film of the 90s. And I mean, it does get fully up its ass at times. Like it really does get very self-important at times. And I love it despite that. Like it's kind of, that's just what it is, man. That's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I guess.
Do you think it got pretentious and self-important?
I think there's pockets where it can, but I would say what film doesn't.
True.
You know, it's like if we're talking about movie making, there's got to be a moment where every movie to some degree, some more than others, is going to have self-importance.
No? If you're trying to have any sort of message, yeah, I think it has to.
Right, because you're redirecting it where you hope that people might go.
Right.
So, yeah. There's probably a little bit of that.
Should we talk about the big spoiler finally? The big thing. Are you going to start crying?
Not at all, actually. Because there's a couple. Okay, you go first because I have a couple issues with it.
Okay. Well,
logistically or practically.
Okay. I want to hear this. Okay, that's interesting. So. The big thing is at the end, Heroin Bob, they call him Heroin Bob because he's afraid of needles and he doesn't take any sort of drugs. So it's kind of an ironic name.
Which makes it an ironic story plot.
Exactly. Exactly. He accidentally overdoses on pills that someone gave him because he had a headache. They told him it was vitamins. And he
cheap out. This is where I got a little lost.
Yeah.
It's a cheap out.
It is kind of a cheap out.
It's a cheap melodramatic pull.
Yes, this is a typical indie.
This is more logistical, though. Like, it still works, and I get it. And Lillard's performance is great.
He needed some sort of catalyst to get him to go to law school.
He had to put. They had to end the movie.
Right. I mean, he could have just had, you know, Bob and Trish going to get married or something, you know, and then
not as fun.
Not as fun. Definitely not as fun. But he needed something.
Not as emotional.
But here's the thing, man. Like, here's another reason why this movie resonated with me. I had my best friend died of an accidental overdose too. And so that was like, we were in our late 20s, I think. And so to me, the more I get older, the more I'm like, this fucking movie is fucking with me, dude. Like it is.
Like an ass. I'm like, hey,
no, but
cause I didn't know that. And now I'm all, hey, those vitamin call outs were, that was dumb.
Well, first of all,
Alan brings in the real drama.
You're not wrong because she's like, he's like, I got a headache. And she's like, take some of these. They're just vitamins. And she dumps them out of a prescription bottle.
That's like, there's just, it just.
And heroin Bob, he's so paranoid of chemicals, he would have seen that and not, you know.
That was the only thing. Right. And so it threw me off. Like, that doesn't necessarily take away, though, it still works. The only reason I say that is because at the very beginning of the movie, he's talking about acid and drugs and all these things and how they're bad for you. And he goes in on a full-blown pep talk speech about how all that shit will kill you.
Let alone
he says it'll kill you. All that stuff, you're dead. And so I just hated that he just was so easy because he had a headache.
Yes.
Like a headache. Seems
convenient.
And then all of a sudden, she pulls out a prescription bottle and she's like, it's vitamins. And he's like, I'll take them. And it didn't land. That doesn't take away it got us there, like you said. It got us to the thing. But it was a little bit of a plot hole that just didn't land.
It's weak. It was a weak way to do it, for sure.
Yeah.
It almost feels like, oh, shit, I'm out of ideas. So
I don't blame him, by the way. It's hard to write and do those things.
It is, for sure. But also, the thing I like about Heroin Bob is he's so paranoid about chemicals and any sort of drugs, like weed or whatever, yet he will let his infected hand go weeks and weeks, and it gets all crusty and black, and he's got to be quarantined because he's got a new disease.
That scene was also funny, where he goes, he's been in quarantine for 3 weeks, and they come in to get him out, and he's like, they named a whole virus after me.
So good. It's so funny.
There's some funny moments with that, too. I get it. I just didn't love how he was so passionate about the thing, and then she pulls out a prescription bottle and says they're vitamins, and he's like, yeah, I'm good.
Yeah.
It's
a little contrived.
Yeah.
But then the big scene happens where Steve-O comes down, and it's kind of a bookend to the very first scene when he kicks Bob awake. So Bob sleeps on a mattress on the floor in their flop house, and Steve-O comes down at the very first scene of the movie and kicks him to try and wake him up, and Bob doesn't wake up. He's like, all right, two more hours. And then this one, he comes down, tries to get Bob awake. He kicks him, and he knows immediately he's dead. And Matthew Lillard puts on one of the most heart-wrenching performances I've ever seen. Like, they just let the camera roll on him. And the things he says, the way he says them, I've seen this movie probably 4 or 5 times over the years. This is the first time I did not cry at it.
Yeah, I didn't cry.
You're heartless.
I am.
You're heartless.
I'm not. Here's the thing.
Justify why you're not heartless. Let's hear it.
Great performance. Yeah. Didn't care about Bob. I just didn't care about him.
About the character or his death?
They shoehorned in the dad thing.
Yeah.
With the CIA. And then we learned later that his dad was an asshole.
Right.
Because they just shoehorned it in, and then all of a sudden he's dead. And you feel yeah. He's like, oh, this is what he did. He's like, I'm going to make you feel bad. Let me show you that his dad's an ass.
Well, they mentioned it a couple times about his dad.
Maybe it just flew over me.
Like, they mentioned when he's quarantined, Mike asked him, you know, did your dad visit you? He was like, no, my dad's drunk.
I didn't get those where I got it more would have been and the metaphors, because I think this is where he landed. I didn't get like the dialogue pieces of that mm-hmm. until they met the dad. The metaphor stuff was interesting. And what I mean by that is at the beginning of the film, when Bob looks in the mirror, he hates himself so much that he punches the mirror.
Yep.
And then at the end, he goes into the bathroom after taking the vitamins. And he punches the mirror. That's what I mean. Those visual representations, how he hates himself. You almost don't need the dad to some degree.
I
mean, they shoehorned it in so you could get his past, but that's all. I'm being nitpicky. Like, there's a lot of things there and it still works, but I wish that Steve-O and Bob would have built that more, and Bob and Steve-O would have been more aware of Bob's inner demons at the start, because he just never was really aware. There's throwaways in the dialogue, but it just didn't land.
Here's my counterpoint to that. I think they threw the dad in there, and I agree. I think they shoehorned that in. I think it was just like, oh, we gotta We got to really drive this home. Like we mentioned the dad, we got to really drive it home. I think they did that to show that Bob has never had a home. He's never had a family. And now that he's got Trish, he feels like Salt Lake is his home. It's the first time he's had a home.
He does transit. But I got that more without the dad.
Right.
When Bob just tells Steve-O, hey, well, Salt Lake's not so bad.
Right, right.
It's not that bad of a place. And he's like justifying his relationship to Salt Lake and his girlfriend.
Yep.
I actually got it more there than I did with like the CIA dad. It just didn't land.
Yeah, it wasn't great. It was very sad, but it wasn't great for sure.
It wasn't really sad. It was stupid.
I think it was sad and only because of Michael Gorjan, who plays Heroin Bob, because of his performance leading up, like when they're driving to meet the dad. To me, like his performance, how he's nervous and like he brought him a birthday present. Like to me, that performance really brings the
Michael
emotion.
Gorjan's great.
He's so good.
In general, I think he's really good in the movie.
Yeah.
But it landed in different pockets and the dad thing was a throwaway shoehorn.
Man, like, you didn't like Heroin Bob's character?
The dad.
Well, I know, but.
We're just going to throw him in here. He hates the CIA. Get a shotgun. I mean, come on. I got it in different ways. That's all.
Right.
I didn't
right.
get it from that scene.
The last thing I'm going to say is about metaphors is they keep talking about death. Like if you watch it, it's not really in your face, but death is mentioned a lot. And basically to me, death means having structure in your life because then you don't have anarchy, you don't have chaos, you don't have freedom anymore. And so they view that as a death. And Heroin Bob, even at the beginning, is like, dude, acid, that's going to kill you, man. That is going to kill you. You can't take that. And later on when Steve-O actually takes the acid, I think that's when the real turn happens with Steve-O. He just hasn't accepted it yet. Because after that, he finds his girlfriend in bed with another dude. He sees Bob is so happy with Trish. Like everyone is kind of going and doing their thing. Mike is going to go save the rainforest, which is just a fantastic scene right there. And Mark, the crazy guy, is gone. Like everybody is doing their own thing. And I don't care who you are. If you get old enough, you're going to have a point where everyone's going and doing their own shit. Yeah. And it's very scary.
Friends evolve.
Exactly. And so that's why, like, I think this, people talk about this being a coming of age film, and it is. I just think this is done so much better than other coming of age films I've seen. If we're leaving all the rest of it out and it's just about that, to me, it's done very well.
I didn't even consider it like a coming. I mean, it is. You're right. Now that you say that, but I was like, oh, this is a like more, and maybe it's both. It's like, this is a slice of life.
Yeah, true.
But this pocket, and there obviously, so maybe there's the coming of age in the sense that there's growth,
yeah,
and he's moving on. But it's just like it's a slice of life. It's this little thing that happened, and we're going to learn and or not learn and move on.
And keep in mind, this is like the fourth or fifth time I've seen it, so it finally clicked with me. I'm in my 40s, and I finally like, oh, now I get this movie that I've loved forever and hated at the same time.
Who's your favorite character in this film?
It's got to be Heroin Bob or Sean, Devon Sawa. One of the two, I think. Because his little acid trip is hilarious.
The acid trip's great.
But Heroin Bob is so endearing. Like, he plays like a lovable idiot so well.
I actually don't think he's an idiot. That's my point. I don't think he's an idiot. I mean, the sophistication in which he delivers his non-drug speech at the beginning, closer to the beginning, like really... He's done some research. He's a pretty smart guy, actually.
I mean, they both graduated college.
So, with good grades.
With good grades, exactly. Okay, so that's it. Should we read some reviews?
Well, first, I didn't want to pass by all the internal drama that you went through on this movie. I feel like, there's a lot. That's a lot of shit, so.
This was like just, there's so many parallels to my life. And I know that I hate being that guy. It's like, this movie really speaks to me.
I don't think you should. I think it's actually a really interesting perspective.
It just hit me on so many levels that not many other films have ever done that, where I can relate to so much that's going on.
It's in a pocket of time where you were relating on every aspect.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Like punk rock.
Yes.
Salt Lake City.
Yep.
Subculture.
Yep.
Mormon.
Yep.
Like, it's just like was lining up on every single fucking facet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we've talked about movies that really relate to you as well. You know, like even, what was it, The Night Before we were talking, or was it The Deer Hunter? We were talking about that. No, yeah, what were we talking about?
I don't know. We've done 70 of these
yeah,
things.
Yeah, I know, I exactly. Know.
But I get what you're saying. It's lining up. And then also, like, now we go visit this in the podcast. Here we are doing SLC Punk on a review, and you're in the midst of making a documentary yeah. around, you know, that culture.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what brought this to the forefront. But there were even a couple lines in here. I'm like, I got to figure out how I can sample this. You know, like I got to talk to Sony Pictures and be like, can you just cut me a deal? I just want to use this one line.
You know, they're famous for that.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's why I chose it. I just, it's.
Well, and also just shout out the documentary you're working on. I mean, I think people should know about what you're doing.
Yeah, it's still early on. We're about, I appreciate that. We're going to start raising money very soon. We actually finally opened up the bank accounts, got all the legal stuff done. And it's going to be about kind of the local underground music scene here in Salt Lake City. And a couple record stores, one's called The Heavy Metal Shop, one's called Raunch Records, that both had a hand in both of these movies. And it's a lot of the same themes, like growing up, not being a part of the culture and trying to find yourself when you are a total outsider. And
I've seen the teaser. It's pretty kick ass. It's pretty punk rock.
I hope so. Well, yeah, we'll release that pretty soon, actually, as soon as we get a couple rights things situated. But
yeah, I love that. Anyway, that's all those alignment cool. things. You got yeah. so many. It's history for you. There's just so many tie-ins to this movie. That's pretty wild. I think that's what we've talked about in the past. It's like, you know, that's what's cool about movies. It's like they're going to hit and resonate in a certain way for certain people. And this one, because of all the things, A, you've gone through and also the things you're working on now and then the tie yep. into all the personal unfortunate events with your friend. Like, that's yeah. crazy how it ties all and you feel it when you watch the movie. And now you're going to hate me when I give the rating.
I think you're going to be surprised by my rating too, actually.
Do we have any Google reviews?
We do. So we have reviews from Letterboxd. I'm going to read one that's kind of long. It's a half star. It's actually kind of insightful. So this isn't one of the goofy ones.
I like that though. That's fair on this one.
Yeah. It's a half
star. We usually like to read the silly ones.
And I have a couple ones. Of those too, but this one's a half star. It's by someone named Alex. And it says, this movie just represents everything wrong with the 1990s era indie-ish filmmaking. 55 million cool rock songs and a dash of overplayed classical music, needless different stylized moments, relentless fourth wall breaks and about 20 freeze frames, 3 million jump cuts, 4 extended rambling swear sessions about how lame certain hip things are. I don't know what that means. I watched this movie with a crowd of people who found this movie funny. I did not. This movie is about as subtle as a bullhorn. The movie makes its position on the punk movement so blatantly obvious and mean-spirited. They're just idiots who fight and fuck and also actually secretly hate their ideology, which is kind of true. It's vapid criticism that lacks room for character drama, even though it at points tries desperately to. And in the end, you just have a prolonged sequence of hip and edgy moments that leave you feeling numb to 90s excess. This person acts like there's no redeeming qualities, which I just totally disagree with. So,
yeah, I agree with him there.
Here's a one
I'm
star.
Just kidding. That was a joke. That's a joke. It's called sarcasm. I was waiting for you to respond. You're like, there's no redeeming quality. And I was like, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, there's none. It's shit.
I just wanted to hear what you said because I don't agree with him. I was joking.
Here's a one star by Haley. Socially liberal, but fiscally conservative punk movie. Haha.
Fiscally conservative?
I think it's supposed to be a joke.
I was going
to
say.
Because he goes to Harvard Law at the end. Yeah. Half star by Whitbritz. Felt like an SNL movie. Why are you married to SLC? You can be a punk somewhere else. Why would you not invite your homeless friend to stay at the punk house? Probably became the evil kind of lawyer.
Actually, I like his point there about not inviting your friend to have a place to stay.
Exactly.
I kind of like that point. I'm not going to lie.
But I think that actually goes into it because Steve-O says he couldn't even look at him. He had to walk away. And I think the reason why is that's his future if he continues to be a punk.
It's definitely a future. I mean, they play into that, but yeah, it's, I don't know. There's something there about, like, you live in a dilapidated building. Yeah. And why not just
Bob sleeps on a mattress off,
how
on the floor.
This is logistical things. Like, how are they even surviving? He said, somewhere he mentions, like, declining financial
right
means
at the beginning
from his parents.
So he says he's got no money, no job.
I know, but then he also, I think there's somewhere where he goes, I don't want your money, but he says it in some way.
Yeah.
So how are they even surviving?
No shit. That's a good question.
How are they not already, what's his face?
They should already be Sean.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And last one, Half Star by Bestie Jeb. I literally can't watch this. I hate everything this stands for so bad. I feel like that episode of Sex and the City where Carrie dates that young guy and wakes up in a nasty ass apartment and has to make coffee with toilet paper. Men will really live like this and see nothing wrong with it. Sometimes I worry about being pretentious and then I realize I don't hold a candle to this shit. Everyone in this was so insufferable and annoying. I'm sorry, Jason Segel.
I mean, that's funny.
I think she's working through some issues there.
No, it's funny writing, though.
It is.
She did a good job writing. Here's what I'll say, though. She sounds like she's a little insufferable herself.
Exactly. Like, she sees this work of fiction and thinks it's like, that's literally how they all live.
You lost me at Sex in the City.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so there's Letterboxd. There weren't really any super, super funny, ridiculous ones. And I think we see that a lot with indie films because just not a lot of people are watching them unless you love film. So that all said, I'm not going to repeat everything I've said so far. I love this movie for personal reasons. I know it's got flaws. Doesn't make me love it any less. So overall, I'm giving it a 7.7 monologues. I'll let you gather your thoughts. You want me to read the IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes?
Please do.
Any guesses for IMDb?
I'm going to say just below you. I'm going to go like 6.4.
7.4.
Oh, a whole point.
Yeah. So
did I just give my score away?
You're like, it should have been 6.4. Rotten Tomatoes. Any guesses on this? This one surprises me a little bit.
We'll go critics. I feel like this is a critical thing where they're going to be more enjoy. It screened at Sundance.
It did.
Premiered there. It's like, I got to go 72 for the critics and 67 for the audience.
Opposite. Critics 62 and audience 89.
It just seems like the critics might have got leaned in more.
It's such an indie film that critics love to salivate over, you know? Yeah. So I would think that it would be higher, but.
All right. Well, that's fair.
Maybe we got to give more credit than we normally do.
Look, I think this is really a movie worth watching, you know? And once again, the apologist in me is like, every movie's worth watching. James, he's definitely got something to say. So, like, for me as a filmmaker and, you know, like, I love when people have a point of view. And it's you started this by going, look, the thing about punk rock is that this is what I actually pulled away from the movie. And so I love that you said it originally, which is like, oh, people are opinionated. Or at least their opinion, there's ways in which you approach opinion. And I love that they're heavy in their stance.
Agreed.
And I feel like he is heavy in his stance. This is my movie. And if you like it or you don't, I don't really care. And I think he's doing that. And I love that. I love that. I wish more people had opinions. You know, like, obviously there's only how many white people doing podcasts about movies?
It's just us. That's it.
It's just me and you. I still wish, if you think about it, what you said, one of these stats you brought up last time was like 4.5 million podcasts or something.
Yeah.
Whatever crazy. It is.
Yeah.
That seems low for at least even for a world of 7 billion.
Right.
That's crazy.
It's insane.
When you think about it that way. So we're doing this because we like it, but I love that he had an opinion. He had something to say. I think it leads into that culture of punk rock. And not being a quote unquote punk rocker growing up. Obviously, I was probably too young anyway, but having that attitude. Alan, this is a perfect way to end it before I get into my score. Sixth grade, graduation program. You practice and then you graduate.
Right.
So we're towards the end of the year. me and three of my friends, you take the last part of the day, the school day, to go practice for graduation. You're singing songs and doing stuff. Me and three of my friends decide one day, we're not going. Early 90s, everyone lines up, goes to the auditorium to practice the sing. We right. hang back in the classroom, hiding under desks, hiding in like backpacks on along the wall. They go out. We go play basketball. My friend Chris comes out. He pretended he had to go to the bathroom. We're out playing basketball. They don't even know. Teachers don't even know at this point.
Right.
He comes out and goes, you guys are dead.
Oh, shit.
They're looking for you.
Oh, shit. That son of a bitch.
By the way, and this is not a joke, my friend Chris, 25 years later, becomes the drummer for Good Charlotte.
No way.
No lie.
What?
Not lying. This is a real story. He comes out and goes, you guys are dead. I go, oh, crap. So we go into the bathroom. Me and my friend Matt, we go into the bathroom. We're literally doing the hiding in the stalls thing. Our feet are right. up on the toilet. Our teacher, who's female, comes in the boys' bathroom and is looking around. And she's not going to open the stall right. if it's closed. And we locked it and we sat up and she's like, okay, I think they're in there, but I'm not going to.
Right.
It's weird if I'm in the show. We go, coast is clear. Come down, walk out the bathroom. She's standing right there.
Oh,
she's
shit.
Like, there you go. She goes, oh, so there you are. Get in the office now. Yells at us, calls our parents. We get suspended for a day. They call my mom. They're like, Gabe ditched out on class. We're suspending all four boys for the day. They can come back to the practice tomorrow. But they suspended us from school for the next day. They didn't let us come to school. I was like, my mom's like, I wake up the next, I'm bawling my eyes
right.
out. I wake up the next morning. My mom's like, you want to go to Blockbuster and get a video game?
Dude.
I'm just saying, like, in a subtle way, she just was like, I don't give a shit.
I love your mom. That you is. That could,
and it's in a like a small frame of that. But right, like, she's like, right. I don't give a shit about what they're
right,
doing.
Right.
Let's go get video. She took me to Blockbuster and I rented video games and that's what I did for the
that. That sounds like the best day off ever, man. Holy shit.
Anyway, that's my mom's amazing. Punk rock. This movie's really punk rock. and she's a punk rock Mormon. See, this is the thing. They don't exist in nature, but
except for one instance.
There's one instance where it's true. So my mom's a rock star, punk rocker. And that's a whole nother podcast. We should probably talk about it. But I'm gonna go. I think it's a movie everyone should watch, particularly like we talked about people in this area or that are familiar with it. I enjoyed the film. You know, it's only like the second time I've seen it. I remember the first time I saw it coming off a LDS mission, I was like, well, I don't know about that film. Like, that's probably, so like, that's probably my response. I was also punk rock enough from my mom that yeah. I was like, it's fine.
Right.
I wasn't offended by it.
Right.
But I was like, I don't know if I like that. And I look at it now and I go, I did like it. I enjoyed it. I thought the performances were good. So I'm going to go with a little less. You went with 7.7
monologues.
Monologues. I'm going to go slightly below, but not a full point. I'm going to go 6.8.
Oh, I thought you were going to go lower than
that. No. 6.8. I'm an apologist, remember?
You are. That's
I'm
true.
I'm like, if it's a movie, you made it.
You did great.
I like how my voice turned into a Simpsons voice right there. Hey, guys. 6.8 redneck beatings.
Love it. Love it.
As I go home and probably listen to a couple country songs.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say hits of acid, but real quick. And then if you've listened this far, thank you very much. I know this was like a little bit of a different show. I just have a quick story about the sequel I want to tell real quick. If you're not interested, you can just tap out now.
Never tap out.
Go check out our website, tameaperture.com. There is a sequel. There's an SLC Punk 2. Steve-O's not in it. Heroin Bob is in it, even though he's dead. yeah, they recast Trish, and then they bring back a couple like side characters. Like Mike's in it. The mod is in it.
I'm not going to watch it. Just spoil. How is Heroin Bob back?
He's dead, and he's telling the story. And
narrator.
But Michael Gorjon has like a bald cap, and it is so awful. Like in this one, he literally cut his hair into a mohawk. But for the sequel, they gave him a bald cap and put a mohawk over it. It looks terrible. It's not a good movie. I'll just say that. But when they were making it, so anyway, I also watched that. In preparation for this podcast, I'm at the, it gets over. And I'm like, man, that was just not good at all. That was like, it, how is this made by the same people? And I'm interested in some of the songs. So I'm looking at the credits to see what some of the songs were. And then they're like, oh, thank you to our Indiegogo supporters. And I was, and I think to myself, this sounds like a movie I probably would have donated to. And so lo and behold, names scroll up and there's my name, Alan Martindale, right there. I have no recollection at all of giving money to this project.
When did this come out?
2016, 2015, something like that.
Oh, you were loving it.
I was so excited. I do remember hearing about it. I'm like, I'm so excited.
You caught the buzz.
Yeah,
and you were like, oh, we're going all in.
Yeah.
$100.
Probably. It's like all I could afford at the time. Yeah. It's like, oh shit, man.
I love that story. That's hilarious. You got a credit. You got a credit on the sequel.
I did. I want my money back. I don't know how much I donated, but I want my money back.
Just pretend the only way that you get to, think of it this way. The only way you get to the sequel is with the original.
It's true.
So your money went to that.
It's true. It's true. But James Merendino also has a series out on Tubi right now. It's actually pretty good. It's called Great Kills. It's like a mockumentary about a documentary crew falling around a hitman. And it's surprisingly good. Like, I got surprisingly sucked into it. So definitely check that out.
I would also say real quick, I was doing a little history research on him, or some research on his history. And it's pretty interesting because he's got some interesting connections into Hollywood and like big executives at MGM. And
does he really?
And that did like really, like my favorite, the 70s Americana type films, Kramer and Kramer,
really,
and these kind of things. So it's really interesting. I would love to talk to him about that experience that he had with those kind of mentors that he had that I was reading the other day. So anyway, interesting backstory.
Dude, there. We should probably hit him up. We'll just scrub my last little diatribe from the podcast. Okay. I think that's going to do it. Very unconventional episode. Thanks for sticking with us. Head over to tameaperture.com. Anything else you want to say? Any
anarchy.
Anarchy.
The Tame Aperture podcast is produced by Dutch Angle Pictures in association with Studio B Productions. Listen, watch, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and YouTube.